Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book I do the review and stick it up here on my podcast feed. Except recently actually, because I've not been doing too much fiction reading or listening to of audiobooks. I've been generally doing other stuff, reading some non-fiction, and in my listening time I've been catching up with some podcasts that I've wanted to get to in a long time as well. And and just in general been a bit busy with, you know, the European Juggling Convention and then getting my life in order a bit and hanging out with my girlfriend, just taking a bit of time off from fiction reading, except for this book that I'm going to review today or talk about today, less of a review, more of a talk abouting kind of thing, which I actually finished a few weeks ago at the European Juggling Convention and only just now have got sort of time and energy to think about what I want to say and inspiration to what I want to say about it. But first of all, a little bit of feedback from the last episode. I chatted with Tamahomi and Jesse about Total Recall book by Gordon Bell, and if you're wondering a bit more about my take on that and about my sort of my own ideas about learning about myself through Total Recall, for the last year I've been keeping a diary and I've written 200,000 words in my diary about my life in the past year. It's quite self-indulgent and I'm not going to do it past now because it was my birthday 2 days ago, so I decided to keep a diary on my birthday last year and I finished it on my birthday this year. But what I did do is go through it and I wrote a short Python script to analyze all of the words that I'd written and see how often and which words I'd use the most. Of course, the most common word that I use was I, and then the, and then and, you know, those kind of things. But the other words that I'd used, I think you'll find quite interesting. Well, I learned a lot about myself by doing this. So this is my own exploration into the ideas of Total Recall and about knowing myself. And that's what the diary was for, really, to sort of get to know myself better, and it works. So I've written a couple of blog posts. They should be up online probably by the end of today. Both of them up online by the end of today. So check out my blog, lukeburridge.com/blog. Couldn't remember the address of my... Of my own website then. Anyway, and because I'm not writing a diary anymore, I'll be putting a lot more stuff, a lot more news on my blog rather than writing it and keeping it private. I'm going to be writing stuff and sharing it in public a bit more as well. Anyway, so let's get back to this feedback. About Gordon Bell's Total Recall. We mentioned in that discussion that no science fiction had really clocked onto the internet and like social networks and blogs and things like as it seems to be today, except the one example that I brought up was Orson Scott Card in Ender's Game, and he sort of talked about more like discussion forums and blogging, sort of like everyone on the internet is equal to put out their views if they want it, and it's the power of their ideas and the power of their thoughts and the network effect of people selecting the good thoughts and the good ideas and bringing them to the top, which really gave people power, gave Peter and Valerie in Ender's Game power on the network. I can't remember what the network was called, but there it was, and I thought that was a very one of the most important sort of science fiction explorations of that idea before it existed, and that's the thing. And Dylan Harris, he wrote back saying blogs and even Facebook perhaps were predicted in 1978 in Hitson Turoff's Network Nation, Human Communication via Computer. And it's in the section Family and Friendship Networks. They even predict those bloody annoying games that infest Facebook. And that's on Google Books if you want to look at it. But that is, of course, futurism. It's not science fiction. And my claim about this science fiction and not seeing the internet coming was... which I think it still holds for the most part. So what else did I want to say? I wrote an email back to Dylan. Let me just get to his... Oh, yeah. So... like cyberspace isn't what social networks are or what the internet is and virtual worlds isn't and stuff like that. But lots of computers featured in science fiction. I mean, let me put it this way. Lots of science fiction authors wrote about computers, but they're always like, okay, this is a computer that will have this very powerful tool aspect about it, or it'll be an artificial intelligence. And most people missed the idea of social networks, that like people everywhere having access to the same network and everyone putting stuff into the same network, be it the internet, be it Facebook, be it Twitter and all these things, and it's sort of them improving and enhancing their everyday lives. Of course, people now in science fiction are writing about it, but it's really hard to keep ahead. And this is something that I tried to do a little bit in my novel called Combat, which I only put out last year. I think early last year I put this. So let's say 18-20 months ago I released this novel, and I wrote it just under a year ago. Oh yeah, so maybe I wrote it like 22 months ago. After a few months I'd revised it and put it out online. And in my novel Combat, bit of spoiler alert here, I actually write about people, this sort of underground faction who are using social networks and hacking to in a African country, an oil-rich African country, using these different technologies to overthrow a government, and how the Muslims and Christians within a society would come together, the young people would come together, use technology and overthrow the kind of government that had been put in place in part by Western powers, or Western powers were propping up this government. And for me, I thought, oh, well, I have to write it about an African nation because, you know, it's the kind of place where this thing would happen next and it could happen next. And then, of course, like a year later, there's these scenes in Egypt and Libya and Tunisia and these other places which show not exactly the same kind of thing, but a similar kind of thing. I'm not going to say I called it ahead of the time, but I don't think me writing about social networks and computer hacking and young people coming together and having more in common with each other via internet and social networks. I mean, it's just one part of Combat. I'm not giving a big spoiler. It's not like the main plot spoiler there, but it does play a part in the end of the novel. And I was just thinking that if I had published that novel in a more traditional way, so if I wrote it a year ago, it probably wouldn't come out for another year, and especially because I'm not a published author. So if I had written that novel, they wouldn't have released it until they'd have released Minding Tomorrow, and then Combat would have come out a year later. I mean, this is, you know, in a perfect world where I get a book deal. Well, not in a perfect world. In another world where I actually care enough to sort of submit my novels to publishers or agents to try and get a book deal. But it would have taken 2 years for this book to come out, maybe 3 years for this book to come out. And in that time, the technology would have moved on in the same way that in Daniel Suarez's book Demon, however you want to pronounce it, he talks about these different social networks, but is obviously behind because he talks about mobile phones twittering, but not as in the phone twittered, as in send a message to Twitter. It's like the phone twittered, as in it rang, it made a twittering noise. And I just found it so telling that this book, which is meant to be on the cutting edge of technology, is just a few years behind, and the word Twitter doesn't have the same meaning to the people in the book as the word Twitter does now. You can follow me on Twitter, I'm at Luke Boach. So yeah, that's the kind of thing that I find interesting about science fiction authors trying to keep ahead of the internet world. It just moves too quickly, and the internet world via Facebook and Twitter and these other social networks influence the real world in so many ways that we can't see coming as well. So how do science fiction writers keep up? I think the way that they can keep up with the internet is by doing what I did and writing a book and releasing it 2 months later after the second round of edits and just get it out there. And I think that's the only way that you can actually write science fiction about the near future, where these revolutions could happen in the world using this new technology. Anyway, I've gone on long enough about that. I really want to get onto today's book, which is R. Scott Baker's The White Luck Warrior. It came out this year, May 2011. It's 592 pages long, according to goodreads.com, which I've just closed that window by accident, and I'm not logged onto the internet yet, so I can't get that back up. Oh well. Hopefully I don't need to refer back to any internet stuff except the pages I just opened in front of me. So I read this book pretty quickly, mainly because it was the fifth book in a series. There's a first trilogy and then there's a second trilogy, and this is the second book in the second trilogy. But I'm just going to go by the books number 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and we'll just call this book number 5. I think there's going to be 6 books so far, and then I read on Wikipedia that there's going to be another 2 books after this trilogy. So it's like a trilogy of trilogies kind of thing. Anyway, I put off reading book number four because the people I knew who read book number four said it's good, but it ends at too much of a cliffhanger and it doesn't really resolve any of the story. And then so I thought, well, I'll just wait until book five comes out and see if it's worth reading on. And then everyone said, hey, no, this next book is worth reading. It gets the story forward and it comes to a satisfying conclusion. You should read this book. So then I read both of these books pretty quickly after each other. After reading the book number four, there was such a cliffhanger and such a sort of like, and next, I was going to leave this book a bit longer, but then I thought, fuck it, I'm just going to get it from Amazon. And so I did, and I read it. So it's quite difficult to review a book like this because it's the fourth book in a series. So if I talk too much about it, I'll be spoiling the books before that have come before. And if I don't spoil the books that come before, it gets a bit vague. But so I'll just go over some wider points, which won't have so many plot spoilers. First of all, this book is very much... Now, especially the last book as well, the Judging Eye, book number four, I said, oh, it's like there's this Mines of Moria sequence. He's just taking, you know, he's taking the tropes that have been established by Tolkien and then, like, going for them head on. And so in this book, it's very much continuing that kind of thing, but it's still got, like, the Fellowship of the Rings, like the Lord of the Rings aspect in it, but quite a bit of The Hobbit comes into this book as well. So in this book, we do have a main army on a quest, like a direct conquest quest, lots of different kinds of armies joining together to battle the orcs from Mordor, I mean the Srank from the north, from the Consult, and meanwhile we have this small fellowship on another path, on the Slog of Slog. So it's a little bit like the Lord of the Rings, but with Hobbit stuff going on as well, because instead of going through the Mines of Moria, our little fellowship goes through Mirkwood, and which is called something else, called the Mop or something, but they go through the Mirkwood and then they're trying to plunder a vault under a mountain, which is not really a mountain, it's under a library, but you know, when they get to these massive amounts of treasure, like in The Hobbit, when they go, hey, let's go and get this treasure, and then when they get there, what do they find? Well, don't be surprised about who turns up guarding the treasure at the near the end of this book, The White Luck Warrior. So you do have these tropes that he's playing with, but he's doing a lot of different things with it, which of course I'll get onto later. So good stuff about this book. Stuff happens in this book. The book for number four, it seems to be, okay, this book number four is set 20 years after book number three, and we've got to sort of like reset stuff, set up the world again, tell where the characters are going, introduce some new characters to follow and things like that. But it felt like very much like the start of something, but only the start of something. It's like, okay, here's setting up, and next happens. No, read that in book four. And book four is definitely stuff happening. So even though the plot, though, isn't progressed much further, but we learn loads more about the world, we learn loads more about the history of the world, not just the world as it is, or as it is 20 years after the previous book, but, you know, all the different stuff that's gone on in the past. There's a lot more about the ancient history of the world. And in a way, when I reviewed the Thousandfold Thought, which is book three, at the end of there, R. Scott Bakker included like this encyclopedia of all of the stuff that he'd thought about when writing the book, and it was almost a spoiler for this book in a way, because there was so much stuff in there. He said, oh, and this is where the non-men come from, and this is where the Srank come from, and now, but it didn't really have much relevance to the plot in that first trilogy, and it has massive relevance to the plot in this trilogy, and we're learning about it through the characters and what the characters know, rather than just going, oh, here's the author's encyclopedia. So in a way, I wish I hadn't read that, and I would suggest if you do get to the third book in the series, A Thousandfold Thought, when you get to the point where it feels like the book has just ended really early and you thought there was a lot more book to come, but it's not a book, it's this encyclopedia bit, don't read the encyclopedia. If you're really confused about anything, you can look it up, but don't just read it all the way through, because it does spoil quite a lot of the mystery, and you get so much of that here in the fourth and fifth books. Another good thing is there's lots of character development. Esmene, who's back home, is developing into a very strong character. She's like this empress figure now that Kellis, who was the main character in the first book, he doesn't get any viewpoint chapters at all. We see him, but at more and more of a distance, which is quite good, I think. But Esmene is kind of developing into the role, kind of that the Empress was. I can't remember her name now, but in the first book, and then slightly in the second book, which is, you know, and her loving son, slightly too loved infatuation fun Kelnomus is kind of mirroring what Confas was in the first book, but the characters, like the character dynamic, is superficially similar, but the power is flipped in different ways there. So it's very interesting and different direction than I was expecting, really. But there we go. And then Mimara, who is Esmene's first child, is now the lead character in this novel. Book 4 was very much about Acamian, and this is the wizard that we met in the first book who becomes this outcast wizard. He's a wizard without a school, so he's just this guy living in the middle of the wilderness. And in that book, Mimara comes up and says, "Hey, we should go do something. You need to teach me this, and we need to go start getting about the world, because Achilles is getting the entire world, and he's changing everything, and we need to not stop this, but we need to do something about this. We need to get to the bottom of this." And Acamian is like, "Okay, let's go." And I thought, "Oh, well, that's cool, because Acamian is doing something." But now in this book, we realize that actually, no, it's Mimara who is the driving force of this team, of this small fellowship. And I didn't really realize that, because Acamian is the one with the power, but Mimara is really the one with the knowledge and the oomph, and she actually set him in motion. And I thought, "Oh, well, she sets him in motion, but it's still really about Acamian." But it's not. You realize in this second book that it's very much about Mimara's journey rather than Acamian's journey. And most importantly, I think in the terms of character development, is Sorwa, and he's the annoying prince king from book 4, and he's on the big army trek north, which is called the Ordeal. And I knew he'd be important, because he wouldn't have been such a main character in book number 4, but here in book number 5 he really sort of gains his status. He earns his status in the book by earning his status in the world of the book, rather than just having status in the book, because he's a viewpoint character. And I really enjoy him, his interaction with those about him, and him learning the language that he has to speak, because otherwise he didn't know anything like that. And his relationship, can't remember the name, Zoronga or something, who's the crown prince of Zuem, or Zium, Zium, Zuem? I can't remember. I don't have, doing this all from memory here. And we get a bit more Kellis, like I say, from at a distance. And he's an interesting character, because we're getting more and more distant from him. He's going off and doing his own thing, and it's like the story is very much about the people that he leaves in his wake and the people whose lives he affects. But I still don't know if he's a good character, if he's a good guy, who is just a bit like autistic, who doesn't care about the people around him. I'm not sure if he's a bad guy but who is sort of doing has a noble goal, like some weird kind of totalitarian fascist guy who really is trying to save the world, but he's doing it in a totalitarian fascist way. But when he's finished his job, the world will be a better place, except that he's got to knock a lot of heads together and disrupt the entire world to be able to save the entire world. So, and then I'm thinking, well, maybe he's not in control. Maybe the Dunyane guys, maybe they send him out into the world. Because in the very first book, this is not a spoiler, in the very first book, the opening chapter of the first book, is Kellis going out into the world for the first time. He doesn't really know why he's being sent out into the world. It's just that he knows he has to go and find his father, who was sent out into the world 20 years before. So he goes out into the world, and then, but it's like he's working without guidance, and I'm never sure if, you know, he even knows what he's doing in the world, even though he is the most powerful man within it. And then we get some other characters who are introduced as well. One guy, I think his name was Melaubi or Melaui. And he's that sounds like an African name, but and that's because I guess Zuim is like the kind of dark, well, like it's like a different civilization. One of the only places that Kellis didn't conquer with his empire. He conquered it. He brought it under his influence in a very interesting way, but didn't conquer it in a military way. And Malawi is then like an observer who is looking into the empire from this outside perspective, and he's a bit of a philosopher as well. And yeah, he can see things going on which other characters from within the empire don't really get a good handle on. So all the character stuff is pretty good, as you'd expect from the, well, if you like the explorations of character that R. Scott Bakker does, you'll like this a lot more than book number 4 and book number 3. However, if you and he's getting better at it as well. There's less people just talking at each other and talking philosophy to each other. It's more internal. The things that people are thinking is more internal, which I like quite a lot. But it, like I say, it is very dense, and it's probably not for most people. Good things now. The slog that the Fellowship of the Ring of the coffers. Again, I don't want to spoil too much, but they called it the slog of slogs, and now it really is a slog. And more importantly, the ordeal, which was the group of armies going north, it was called the ordeal, but it didn't sound in book number three. No, sorry, book number 4. It didn't actually seem that bad in book number 5. Now, very, very bad. And it's not just like against external enemies. And in book number 2, which was called the Warrior Prophet. It tells of a crusade which tries to get across a desert, and everything goes really, really bad. And in a way, the desert is more deadly than any human army that they come across. And in this book as well, we start getting the same kind of thing. But in book 2, when the army crossing the desert ran out of water to save supplies, the leaders of the army said, "Okay, all of the camp followers and slaves, we can't give them any water. It's an emergency situation. So all of the slaves and the whores and the camp followers have all got to be put to death to save supplies, and we're going to go out, or we're just going to discard them. If they try and take any supplies, if they do anything, we're just going to kill them and go without them. We're going to take the horses and go." And that's what the army does, but we don't really see it too close up, you know. And of course, all the main characters survive. But as in this book, Kellis knew this might happen when they were going north, and he said to all the princes and nobility and all the armies, they said, "Okay, you can't bring slaves with you, you can't bring your whores, your mistresses with you, you can't bring anything like that. You've just got to bring your tent, bring your weapons, bring your little pony, you bring your horse, and let's go." And they all complained about it so much that in the end he said, "Okay, you can bring your slaves with you if you like, but don't blame me if something happens to them." And in this book, he gives the order, "Okay, it's come to the time, we're running out of water, we're running out of food, kill your slaves. But you've got to kill your slave yourself. If you brought your slave along, if he's your personal slave, you've got to kill him by your own hand." And in this case, in this book, the slaves are really important characters. They're like the friends and companions. They're almost equal, because when everyone's at war, it's just, you know, if you're a man, you're a man. You carry your own weight, and everyone's doing that kind of thing, except some people happen to be nobility, and some people happen to be the slaves belonging to the nobility, and then they have to kill the slaves. And this really, like, they have to kill themselves, their slaves themselves, which is killing their friends, killing their lifelong companions, and it's really harsh. And this is even worse for, well, not even worse, it's bad for the characters who have lived their whole life for it, but Sawa, who is the prince from the north, he lived in a society where there were no slaves. Everyone was a free man. And in book 4, he is given a slave and said, "Okay, this is your slave, you've got to look after him." And he immediately goes, "Well, okay, slave, you can go free." And he signs this thing to say the slave now belongs to him. And he tries to burn the deed, the receipt for his slave. And he doesn't want it. And the slave stops him burning that. And so, even though they can't speak the same language, he says, no, don't do that. I'm your slave. I'm your willing slave. And in this book, he gets the order that he's got to kill this guy just when he's become friends with him, or just when he's become a companion. And it's like really, really gut-wrenching. I think it's a very clever twist. I thought, oh, we're just going to have the same, like, book 5, the second book in this is where the armies are trying to get to where they need to be to go to, you know, to have the battle. It's going to be reflecting the second book, and it does, but it sort of reflects on itself in a way more interesting way. Well, not in an more interesting way, but we know what kind of things can happen, but now we have to confront them head on. You're going to kill your slave? You got to kill your slave. Death is way more important in this book than it was in the previous books. Not just because we care about them, but because the characters who are in the book, they're made to care about death in a way that they haven't been before. And what else? Yeah, battle sequences, pretty good too. And the writing style always changes for the epic battle sequences. Backer switches to this more omniscient narrator, and we get like this wide epic telling. In these sections, he mentions these figures that we don't know, but who everyone in the world would know, like the legendary leaders. And it's like, yes, and this duke and this king rose up and did this, and then this hero slew this hero that we don't know, but the characters would know them. These are the people that the legends are told about, and the histories will be written about them. Tolkien does this a bit in his books, like, you know, The Hobbit and The Fellowship of the Rings. They start off like in an adventure kind of story, almost like pulp-like kind of adventure story. And then in The Two Towers, the writing becomes a bit more epic. It becomes a bit more sort of medieval saga kind of writing. And then in the final book of the Lord of the Rings, was it The Return of the King, the language becomes almost biblical, like ancient epic, like Greek tragic epic kind of language as well. As they grow closer to the end, and the battles get bigger and bigger in that way. Backer uses the same kind of tones in this writing, but he switches from them from chapter to chapter, and I just think it makes the battles more epic and can tell actually the details of the battle from every direction without one of our viewpoint characters having to be there. And then when it switches away from the battle, you'd plunge right into the very front bit of the brain of our main characters. So there's some good points. Bad point, the pacing. It's a long book and there's quite a lot of time slogging. And I quite like the idea that a slog is a bit of a slog to read, and the ordeal is an ordeal to read, but not when I'm the one doing the reading, thank you very much, because the writing is dense, and the plot, like you say, the plot doesn't progress very far. There's lots of things are happening, and the characters are going through lots of experiences, but you could say, okay, what did this character want at the beginning of the book? Do they still want it? Yes. Where was this character going at the beginning of the book? Are they still going there? Yes. What's this character trying to organize at the beginning of the book? Are they still trying to organize that? Yes. You know, so there is character progression, but their characters are changing and the situations are changing and we're getting more knowledge, but there's not been like, okay, this person is heading in a different direction, which in a way is fun, because, well, not fun, it's bad in some ways, that because I really want it to move on, but then I don't want people doing things just for the sake of doing things. Like in the Game of Thrones, one of my complaints about that was a character was heading this one direction, and they go, okay, no, I'm not going to go there anymore, I'm going to go over here, and then they wander over there, and then they say, oh no, I don't want to be here, I'm going to go back again, and then they track back again, and I'm just thinking, why did you go all the way over there to have that one conversation with someone, and then go all the way back in the other way, and then go back to where you came, and then head out in a different direction? And of course, that's what life is like. I do that kind of stuff all the time, I'm traveling all over the place, but now I read the reviews, some of these reviews of the fifth book in the Game of Thrones, was it Dance with Dragons or whatever, the one that's just come out, is it Dance with, yeah, and people are saying, oh, it feels like he's just moving people around the board, he's just moving people from place to place to get them into position, and it's like, well, wasn't he doing that in the first book? He was just moving people from place to place to get them into position. So I actually quite like that all of the things that happen in this book happens with people trying to get from one place to the other, and it's quite linear in that way. The writing is good. It's very dense, but I like it. Dense is good. The philosophical ramblings are good, but sometimes the writing is a little bit too dense and the philosophical ramblings get in the way of the characters and the plot. It is a step up, though, I think, from books one and two in this way, because in that time there was lots of, like I mentioned before, two characters just talking to each other about philosophy, about, oh, this is what we do now, and this is what we do now, and we do now. But and it's a little bit less about that. Like I say, it happens a bit more within people's minds and the things that they notice rather than things that they just say to other characters. A lot of the slog is, you know, people don't even talk to each other. When you do get some people talking to each other, you go, well, why are you talking to each other? And the reason for this, let me get onto this. This is a point that I forgot about, but now I want to talk about. So here's a question in Tolkien. It's like, where people walk from place to place a long way. There's a lot of walking in Tolkien, which I think is, again, why we have the slog and the ordeal in this book. They just call it what it is. It's a slog. So, and you look at the map and you go, wow, they walked all the way from there. What did they eat along the way when they walked through that empty plains? And what did they do? Where did they get the energy? And I looked at the map in this book as well, and I go, okay, so in book four, they made it about 2 centimeters across the map. And in this book, they've got to make it 10 centimeters across the book, across the map in book number 5. And I'm like, wow, that's going to be a long way. How are they going to make it all the way across there? What are they going to eat? And how are they going to get across there that quickly? And in The Lord of the Rings, they had this elven bread. I can't remember what it's called, but they wrap it up in leaves. And one slice can keep a man going for a week or a month. I can't remember. I remember in the book. No, not in the book. Maybe it's in the book, but in the movie. I've watched the movies more recently than I read The Lord of the Rings. And they say, oh, this bread can keep a man going for 2 weeks with just a single slice. And Sam or, you know, Pippin or whatever goes, oh, I ate 4 for breakfast, you know, something like that. Maybe it's not in the book, but it's in the movie. It's a fun line in the movie. And so that's what they have there. And in this book, we have a different take on it again. You know, Bacco is going, aha, this is what we have in Tolkien. And this is this kind of thing that gets discarded or not even mentioned in so many fantasy books. When people go on a quest, it's like, well, what are they eating along the way? And what keeps them going? And how can they just walk every day without just dying? And in this book, we have a thing called Quiri, which is this substance which was introduced in book number 4 as they're going through the mines where they were being chased by the by what was ever in the mine. And our elf character, our non-man, who's called Ishriel, I can't remember his name actually, but we'll just call him the non-man or elf. And he gives them this substance which gives them all a boost and it keeps them going. And that's what he does in this book. He keeps giving it to every evening. He gets them all round and they all line up and they all get a little mouthful, well, not a mouthful, like a little bit of this query put on their tongue. And it's like crack cocaine. It's like heroin. It's like ecstasy or whatever it is. It's massively damaging to their health, but it keeps them going and it's massively addictive as well. So a big part of this book is about, well, how do we get all the way across here? How do we walk all the way from there to there? Without seeing any other civilization, because we're just walking through a wilderness, how do we do it? Well, how you do it is get addicted to some really, really powerful shit. And of course, people's thoughts start going all over the place. They do weird shit. It gives like a whole different dimension to this band of characters, because like the power balance is all upset, because there's the general who held power and then a Cameron who holds power. And now the non-man who holds power in the consult, who is, you know, who's always sort of looming over them, is holding power. And Mimara, who has got the judging eye, is holds power as well. And then there's the guy who isn't on the drugs. There's a few of them, because they sort of round up some other people onto the slog. And these guys don't get the drug, and so they're actually walking for real. They're just keeping up because they don't want to die. They don't want to be killed by the orcs. I mean, the Shrank. So that's interesting stuff. Now, anyway, I want to get onto the main point of this review. Wow, I've talked for 30 minutes already. I didn't think I had that much to say about this book. I guess I do. So let me talk a little bit about a blog post that Jesse, or is it Jesse or Tamahomi, sent me, and it's about Scott Bakker. And I just did it. No, thank you. Sorry, someone knocking on my door for room service. So let me see if I can find it here. So it's a blog called Requires Only That You Hate, which is a great title for a book. And on the about page, it said specific geek rage, what it says on the tin, hatred being the emperor's greatest gift to humanity. You see, I talk about race and gender and all that stuff, though by no means do I pretend to be the god of social justice. So and it's a cracked moon is the author of this blog. Anyway, so she writes this blog post called R. Scott Bakker, Prince of Misogyny, and it starts like this. I'll just read the first two paragraphs. I admit that I've never read beyond the 5 pages of Bakker's debut novel, The Darkness That Comes Before. It may have something to do with the fact that the thing opens with a little boy being raped repeatedly, though really the writing is leaden as fuck too. What you need to know about Bakker's books, though, is that in his setting, women are objectively spiritually inferior to men, and that throughout his books, people are raped a lot, not just women, mind, but even so. It's a lot of rape to go around, a lot of juvenile grimdark. I'm not quite sure what grimdark means. He goes, a lot of people complained about this, Bakker fired back with this, and then it sort of goes through some blog post or some question and answer thing that Bakker wrote about the him being called misogynistic and the inferiority of women, and that kind of stuff like that. And yeah, so it's an interesting, well, I wouldn't say it's an interesting blog post, but it's an illuminating blog post about someone who thinks that R. Scott Bakker is misogynistic, and the reason why they think he's misogynistic, and R. Scott Bakker's reply to the blog post, which was written after he wrote his response to it, which I'll get onto in a minute because I think that's quite important here. So, the first thing to say about this rape, yes, the book opens with rape because rape is serious business. Rape is a weapon. If a book opens with murder, that's fine, but rape, not fine. I'm not sure how that works out. Of course, rape is a lot more... let me put it this way, people will attach a lot more power to rape or meaning to rape because it is sexual, it's normally man on woman, and it is, you know, it's got a whole lot more connotations than someone being stabbed or shot or anything like that. So rape is a big thing. However, that it opens with a boy being raped is no mistake, and that women are raped throughout the book is no mistake. But it's not just women who are raped throughout the book, it's a lot of men are raped throughout the book. And even when they're dead or when they're dying or anything like that, it's because these orcs in this book, they're not just orcs which are dug out the ground and it's like, okay, now you will fight for me, you will fight for Mordor, you will fight for Sauron or Saruman or whatever like that. And it's like, okay, we'll fight. The thing is, these are super orcs. They're called Shrank because they are more than just killing machines. They're actually... we find out that using the, mild spoiler here, using different genetic manipulation and crossbreeding, the Shrank are, in the same way that the orcs in Tolkien are sort of men crossed with elves to make them, here they cross non-men with human men and make and manipulate them into these monsters which want to kill. But not only kill, that's one drive, they also want to rape. So it gets to the point where that's all they do. They live for killing and raping. They're specifically designed to clear the continent, or at least the northern region of this continent, for the consul to clear the place of humanity. And they do a really good job of it. R. Scott Bakker knows what he's talking about when he's talking about rape. That's what you need to put rape in a book for, is as a weapon, because in wartime, rape is a weapon. It's not like pillaging and murder, oh, and a bit of rape. No, rape is the main, one of the main things that you use in medieval times as a weapon against the society or the nation or anything that you're attacking. And this is written as very much a take on, I mean, the first three books was written, it was like a it was like a rewriting of a spiritual crusade from one religion against another to reclaim a holy city, you know, like the Second Crusade or the Fourth Crusade, or what, you know, whichever one actually got, I can't remember which of the Crusades managed to get to Jerusalem. I think only two of the Crusades managed to get there. But yeah, it's that same kind of thing. And people talk about the Crusades you know, once the European Christian knights got into Jerusalem, there was blood just draining through the streets of Jerusalem. And, of course, lots of raping going on as well, I'm pretty sure. And it's not covered up. It's part of the weaponry here. Secondly, I'll get back to rape later on in this thoughts, because I've written down some notes, so I know which order I'm doing this. Second, misogyny. Yes, there is misogyny within the book, but like I say, it's in context, it's in historical context, it's set in a very patriarchal medieval setting with different empires, and it's all, like I say, the religions, it's all, the religions are all based around male prophets and male aspects of God and things, you know, it's fictional religion, but it's, but strangely enough, the spirituality is real, the gods actually do exist, magic really does work, prayer can work, but, you know, it's very much based around the male side of all of that. And yeah, so it's a misogynistic setting in many ways, but does that mean that R. Scott Bakker is a misogynist? And he says in this blog response, he says, you haven't read it to the end yet, you don't know where I'm going with this. People read the first book, but we're five books into a series of probably eight books of a series that hasn't finished yet. And people, if you've not read, if you haven't read to the end, you won't see what the entire story is about, which is, you know, true. There's more going on here. And let me just go back and read out. Let me find this webpage again. Okay, this is how A Cracked Moon talks about this book. I admit that I've never read beyond 5 pages of Backer's debut novel. So, 5 pages, and now I've read five. That person's read 5 pages, and now I've read 5 books. So I'm gonna just, you know, I'm just gonna say that I might know a little bit about more about the world and about the characters and about this story than someone who's read 5 pages. So yes, in the first book, in the first trilogy, you do have this very set society, which is a very misogynistic society. But then we get book number 4, and book number 5, and we realise that there's just way more going on here. It says in the opening of this, females are objectively spiritually inferior to men. And maybe in the first book that was true, and in the second and third book it was true, but we get to book 4 and 5 and we realise actually that's all being flipped on its head. We find out that the most powerful goddess, the most powerful god of the 100 gods or whatever it is, or 1,000 gods, I can't remember, is called Yatwa. And Yatwa is a mother god, a female goddess, and is the most powerful. And she has the most worshippers. But before, we didn't really meet the worshippers because all the people that we met were the nobility and things like that. And it turns out Yatwa's worshippers are all the slaves. And I mentioned that we spend more time with the slaves in this book. And they're the menial workers and slaves and household help and things like that. And they all worship a female god. And the main spiritual leaders of the biggest and most powerful religion in the world, or most powerful goddess in the world, are females. They're all females, and females are the ones controlling the world as well. And we also find out that the witches, in the first books, there was no female magicians, wizards, witches, whatever you want to call them. They just weren't allowed because it was a misogynistic thing. And now that women are allowed to start, practicing magic, which is a policy by Kellis, just because he wants as much magic available as possible to go and beat the consult at the end of the ordeal. That's the whole point of the ideal, that they want to get rid of the consult. So he's like, yeah, let's get these female wizards, witches, whatever you want to call them. Turns out, way more powerful than the male wizards. They understand the magic better. They're way better at magic. They're more powerful at magic. And you realise that the suppression of the female aspects of religion and magic and society, they've been repressed all the time, is because they're too powerful. It's because they actually hold more power than the male versions of magic. They hold more power than the male aspects of God, or the male versions of God. And sure, it's the actions of a male, Kellis, who is sort of allowing these female aspects of the world to come through. But it's definitely coming through. So in book 4 as well, I counted, because people talk about rape all the time. Now, of course, like I said before, the Shrank, non-human rape machines, that's what they do. But I tried to see, you know, if there was any other rape going on in the book. Guess what? One rape in book number 4, one human-on-human rape, and it was a woman raping a man. Good going. The Kellis, when he has his armies, now when they conquer a city and stuff like that, rape is no longer a weapon. He doesn't do it. They sack the city, but there's no rape. There is slavery. He does bring people into slavery, but rape is no longer a weapon for Kellis. It's not part of his arsenal anymore. And now we're in book 5, and I'm thinking, okay, who are the more powerful people in book 5? In the first trilogy, there was a very powerful woman, but only because she happened to be the mother of Emperor Confas. Confas? Yeah, maybe. I can't remember his name now. Conria? No, I can't remember. In this book, the most powerful woman in the world is Esmene, and she's not the most powerful woman, she's the most powerful person in the entire empire. She is left in charge of the entire empire while Kellis, leaves on the ordeal. And Kellis intentionally keeps himself distant from the empire, cutting himself off. For his own reasons. But what this brings about is that it's all down to Esmene and one of her closest advisors, who happens to be her daughter, who is another woman, and that those are the people in power. She is the person keeping the entire empire together. And if she isn't keeping the entire empire together, it's up to her to deal with it. And when people come against her, it's up to her to deal with the people who come against her. So that's a different turn. Mimara, like I mentioned this before, on the slog, she is taking over that storyline. She has more power over Akemian than any and the other characters on the slog than we first suspected. And in a way, she even has power over the, well, not the consults, but some aspects of the consult too. And then in the ordeal, who's kicking ass? Well, it's the women. It's like the men are fighting, and when the men need fighting, who comes up and save the day? The female magicians. And when the male magicians, when the wizards fail and they start fighting among themselves, as like men are, you know, probably going to do, who's there to mop up? The women. And then Kellos is Nesmene's second daughter, Serwa, her name is. She plays a big role in this book. She not only leads the female wizards, but she has a lot of power within the ordeal, within these four different groups of armies. At one point, the armies, it was just one group of armies, but they split into four parts to be able to get food and to be able to move more quickly. And it's obviously that the reason that she's not been put in charge of one of these four sections isn't because she's not capable, it's because the other soldiers, the male soldiers and other male leaders, wouldn't take orders from a woman. And it turns out that Serwa would have done a way better job than the men who are put in charge. And the men who are in charge are put in charge fail. And it's, again, it's down to the women to save the day. And by the end of the book, she's carrying two men. And I don't mean that figuratively, she's literally carrying two men to get yeah, I don't want to spoil too much, but yeah, it's an interesting turn. So I've got to give it to Backer. His take on feminism or on feminist or misogyny is way more complex and more compelling than most takes that I ever read in fantasy or science fiction or fiction in general as well. Within a perfect world, you could write a story where there's no differences between the status of males and females. Like, you know, in The Left Hand of Darkness, that can be done. So, you know, if you really, that's a real feminist take, I say real feminist, someone like, which is a proclaimed feminist take. It's like, okay, I'm going to explore issues of gender and sexual equality by putting everyone together in a world, I think it's The Left Hand of Darkness, yeah, putting everyone together in a world where there is no male and female, there is only one sex. But that's a book about our world, and showing a world where everyone is equal, it comments on our world and the struggles that are going on in our world. However, if you want a book about females fighting to be equal and females fighting for their place and fighting for power and fighting for equality, where's the most effective place to start? It's not in a society like we have in The Left Hand of Darkness, where everyone is equal, where there is no difference between male and female, even if there is male and female. You want to start off in a medieval setting, which is based like how our world was 1,000 years ago, or, you know, around about then, where women are spiritually second class, where they are second class citizens in every respect. And then you've got somewhere to go. Then you've got somewhere to, like, and that's up. You've got to go up from there as well, like that. And it seems like this second series really is in part about the establishment of a more equal society, or if not the establishment, the struggle to get a more equal society. We see, you know, the treatment of slaves now is totally different. You know, like, slaves were not part of Kellos' plan for the ordeal. And when they are, it's like, okay, if you keep a slave, you take full responsibility for that slave to the point of, it's your life or his, you know, that's what the thing is. You kill your slave or you die yourself. That's the thing. So slavery is having a big issues here. And of course the gender equality is coming into it a lot more as well. So, yeah, you've got to go up. And that's why I find Esmene and Mimara and Serwa and the other female characters, there are a few other female characters, they're far more interesting than the normal kind of fantasy trope of empowered female character, because they're often just females with their femininity like suppressed just enough that they can still put on a skimpy chainmail and swing a sword and look really good doing it, but they're just like almost like a male character with breasts, because what they have to fulfill in the plot is the role of a male character rather than getting themselves, because, you know, females, I just want to put this out there, female and male are different. We have different strengths, we have different thoughts, we have everything like that. We can be equal, we can be unequal, but it's very difficult to say that one person, one gender or a female is going to be exactly the same if they were male. Just by swapping sexual organs, they do become a different person and they do have a different role or a different function and things like that. In most fantasy, you know, fantasy. Let me put it this way: in a fantasy book like Brandon Sanderson, he, because I listen to the writing excuses, and he says I'm not interested in writing books about a misogynistic medieval world. The worlds that I write in, he says, are a lot more equal. You know, women always have a lot more rights. They're not cooped up and as slaves and as mistresses and whores. They're out there doing things in the world. And say in like Warbreaker, you know, one of the main characters is female and she goes out and kids, and Mistborn as well. If you're one of the Mistborn, if you can manipulate the different metals and or whatever they do, if you're good at what you do, men, females, equal. You do the same job, have the same function in society, even though on the surface of it, on the wider society, males are still in charge, females still have a lot of power. So in a way, it sort of matters less that some of them are female characters. They could have been young men and not young women. Of course, it's great that they are women as well. I'm not knocking it in any way. I'm not saying that it should have been male. But in most fantasies, it doesn't matter if a man is a man. They could have been a female and the story would have been the same. The theme would have been still the same. But in most fantasies, the females are just lower status by just like, oh, yeah, we're in a medieval society. So, of course, women are lower status. So I'm just going to go with that. And men are going to be the important characters in this book. And the females are going to be the love interests or whatever like that. That's like the take of most fantasy authors, that it's just taken for granted that men are higher status. So your main character is probably going to be a guy. But in this series, it really, really matters that these female characters are female, because if they switch gender, it would mean that there's, you know, they wouldn't just be wearing different clothes. They wouldn't just have different sex organs. They would have, you know, the function in the story and what the story is about and what the themes of the book about would be totally, utterly different. And it would be impossible to write this story about females becoming more important in the world and struggling to become equal. And this is a quote from R. Scott Bakker. He said about this very topic, he says, books that interrogate misogyny, that ask genuinely hard questions about gender as opposed to politically correct ones, become shunned as misogynistic. And I think if you just did read the first series of this book, you would say, oh, okay, this is a misogynistic world, and he's just doing what fantasy normally does, is just existing within a medieval misogynistic world. But no, I think in this second series, he really does show what you can do by breaking the mold from this misogynistic society. And just to bring it back again to rape, just a final comment on this. Oh no, I've got one more thing to say, but I'm not quite sure how to say it, but let me put it this way. One more thing about rape is that, you know what I find rape really offensive? Not just that rape exists in fiction is really offensive, because I think if it's used well in a book, it can be very, very powerful. What is most offensive to me, one of the most offensive uses of rape in the book, is by another Canadian author, by Robert J. Sawyer, Hominids. It opens with a woman getting raped for no other reason to get our sympathies and to be, oh, I can't trust men anymore because I was raped this one time and I'll never be able to love a man again. Oh, but I can love this guy who isn't a man. He's a Neanderthal. Oh, great. So what was the rape about? No, nothing. The rape was about nothing except that one thing. And there was this thing, like, she'd go, oh, rape, and I would go to get my counselling, but I don't want to be counselled, like this. And it's just pathetic. And it's like, if you want a man writing about rape in a really insulting way, read Hominids. If you want a man writing about rape in a way which treats rape as the important subject it is, or can be, or should be, or not should be, as it is, as a, like I say, rape as a weapon, rape as a form of intentional misogynistic overpowering of women in society. Yeah, I mean, you can do that. You can see that here in the Prince of Nothing series, in this Aspect Emperor series, and then yeah, like I say, I think it's just a better take on it and a more interesting take. Thirdly, here we go. The Darkness That Comes Before is the book of the is the name of the first book, and I'm just moving around here. I've got pins and needles in my arm. I've been resting on my arm. I thought I was going to take about 20 minutes to talk about this, and it's probably going to be one of my longer episodes because I really want to get this thing at the end here. About this blog post, I could have just talked about the idea of misogyny or misogynistic and rape and feminism issues in The Darkness That Comes Before and the full series just by talking about it. But I wanted to talk a little bit about this blog post in particular. So Here's what R. Scott Baker says. He's being quoted in this blog post, so this is what he says. He goes, "Those who decide my books are misogynistic cannot help but find evidence to confirm their view, just as people who decide my books are feminist, my intention, cannot help to find evidence confirming their view." And he goes on to say, "Once people socially commit to this position, that his books are misogynistic, then it's game over. Others challenge them because the books are really more complicated, like I try to explain here. And suddenly, their case becomes a matter of in-group prestige." And then he says, "Is it me blaming the reader? Fucking A, it is." And it's quite strange because the response that that this blog gives is, let me just quote here, "Lol." Ah, yeah, I'm just taking quote. I'm not taking these out of context. This is, I'm not saying this is what it sounds like this person is saying. This is actually what they're writing here. "Lol." And, "Oh, isn't he adorable?" You know, and it's really strange. And then at the bottom, it says at the very end of it, it goes, "Backer has taught me that it's always the reader's fault you come across as a sexist douche. It's incomprehensible that anyone would find his text misogynistic, despite the women are objectively spiritually inferior to men, and that it's a perplexing sideshow even." This is a comment in the blog here. You should read it. And then it says, "3, writing misogynistic texts in a genre full of misogynistic texts constitutes significant risk-taking. Thank you, Mr. Baker." So, yeah, and I'm thinking, like, did you not read what he said? It's like, oh yeah, of course, first of all, you've only read 5 pages of a 5-book series, and you don't know that him writing this misogynistic text turns out it's not misogynistic text, and in a genre full of misogynistic text, he is actually taking a risk, I think, with the direction he's taking these books. And yeah, it's a bit strange. So what I want to say about this is, first of all, if you've only read 5 pages of a book, shut the fuck up about it. But Baker does write books that are dense. It's true. So a lot of that denseness is about getting to the root of characters, getting to the root of their thoughts and their motivations. And that's the main superpower in the first few books of this series, of Kellis, our main character in the first few books. His superpower is that he knows the basis of his own thoughts. And by extension, with his training and by his breeding, he knows the extension of the thoughts of others. Not the extension, he knows the root of the thoughts of others, that their thoughts are just an extension of what they have thought before and what has come before them in terms of what they've done, what other people have done to them, what they've said, what other people have said to them, and all that kind of stuff. So if you know why you think something, you have power. And if you know why you know you think something, you have more power. And in a way, if you know why you think one thing over another, it gives you more power over your own thoughts, and you can think deeper, and by thinking deeper you can work out why you're thinking things, you know. So it's those who don't think about why they think. They live in not in the darkness, they live in the light, but only for the moment, because they know what they're thinking. If you don't know what you're thinking, you're in continuous darkness. If you know what you're thinking, you're in the light. But if you don't know why you're thinking what you're thinking, you're in the light now, but before you is darkness. You don't know what thought or action or event made you think what you're thinking now. So think about that for a minute. Do you know why you're thinking what you're thinking now? It may be because you're listening to this podcast and I've just told you that. Of course. But anyway, the darkness that comes before, the title of the first book, is not a title about how dark it was in the dark times of the past history of the world and how it's going to get better and this is a struggle to get the world out of darkness and into the light. No, it's about the mindset of people. The darkness that comes before, people living in ignorance of the reasons why they think what they think and why they do what they do and why they have the attitudes that they have the attitudes. And unfortunately for this blogger called A Cracked Moon on this Requires Only That You Hate blog, Backer's thesis holds true. This blogger knows nothing about the real content of Backer's work. They've only read 5 pages. And if they'd read 5 books like I have, they'd be hard-pressed, I think, to call him a misogynist in the way that they're doing. Of course, he's writing about misogyny rather than being a misogynist. So it's like, where did this blogger begin thinking? And it's like, okay, they read 5 pages, okay, and they had a view in mind, and they had the reputation of Backer's books in mind, but this is secondhand information passed through the judgment of other reviewers and other people who talk about it. And if you're like a blogger who writes about feminism and race, you're probably going to have read about R. Scott Baker's books before through that lens. And And of course, within this blog, Backer has responded. He dissects this very approach, like I said before. It's like, if you go into my book, a character in my book will think 1,000 thoughts, but you'll concentrate on the ones about sex. And then that thought about sex could be taken any different ways, but you'll take it in different stuff like that. And he actually explains how people are manipulated by their own expectations and preformed judgments about his book, to the point that they won't buy his book or read his book, and then they will start talking about his book as though they know his book, even though they don't know his book, because he hasn't even finished writing the full story yet. So he says, actually near the end, he says, "All I can hope is that the overall reputation of the series will survive and eventually overshadow this perplexing sideshow of people reading the first book and not getting it and then reading the second book." That's the perplexing sideshow of all this talking about misogyny, of him being misogynist when he shouldn't be. So it's like on every level, R. Scott Backer has come before this blogger. He is, like, at every level, he is working beyond them to the point where he's refuting every point that this blogger makes before they make it, even when the blogger doesn't understand the point that Backer is making. And I really pity the blogger, because, you know, it's like, it's really strange. It's like the blogger is responding to R. Scott Backer here, not the other way around. And yet you might as well read it by seeing the attitudes on display of this blogger, and then R. Scott Backer is going, yeah, you think that because of this. You're thinking that because of this. The reason why you have these attitudes is because of this. He explains point by point why this blogger has the attitudes and why they're having the reaction to this book that they've not read, and Backer is explaining why they're having that reaction to this book that they've not read, and yet he isn't responding to this blog post. This blog post is responding to him. And yet he's come before them in such a way. Anyway, it just sort of like, that's why I found this blog post, which isn't very well written from an ignorant point of view. I just think it explains why I find Backer's writing more interesting than other people's, is because he can dissect people's personalities and dissect people's attitudes. And that's what his books are about. It's about knowing what you're doing or why you're doing it and you're thinking. Although he does say, but the writer of this blog does say that his books are leaden and dense, which is true, and he does say that Backer can come across as a bit of a dick in his writing, his non-fiction writing, like in his blog posts and in his interviews and stuff. And to be honest, I agree with that as well. Maybe R. Scott Backer does come across as a bit of a dick, but just because he comes across as a bit of a dick doesn't make him misogynist. And he even comes before that person. He goes, when it comes to misogyny, my answer has been fairly consistent, I think. First, I am sexist insofar I think men are generally less competent than women across the majority of modern social contexts. Well, how about that? He's saying that women are probably better at maybe having interviews with people and talking about misogyny. Maybe women are better at talking about sexism and feminism, you know, on blogs and in interviews. Maybe women are, you know, just better at social interaction than a nerdy philosophy student and science fiction or fantasy author is about talking about these kinds of things in interviews and on blogs. He's not going to be the best guy. He's going to come off as a bit of a dick because he's a male. Women are going to be better at this. So even in the criticism that he is a dick, and, you know, in his writing, his non-fiction writing and in his interviews and in his interactions with the world, he's like, oh, yeah, great. And if I was a woman, I'd probably be better at it. I'm going to be sexist about that way. And even then he gets called sexist for pointing out the fact that as a nerdy male fantasy writer, he's probably not going to come across in the best light. Anyway, so that's what I have to say about that subject. Wow, yes, I've gone over an hour on this book. I can't believe this, because I didn't review this book for a long time, because I thought, well, it's a last book in it, or, you know, in a book in a series. I don't want to spoil it too much. What can I talk about? Turns out I had a lot of things to talk about. So I'm going to give this book 4.5 stars. I think it gets the series back on track. I think I gave the last book 4 stars. I really, really enjoy these books. Like I say, the subjective rating, guys, girls who are reading this, okay, subjective rating. If you didn't enjoy the first book in this series, for God's sake, don't read it. And if you don't like the idea of having to read through leaden writing and obtuse philosophical ramblings, and people go, oh, it's not philosophical enough. It's like pseudo-intellectual. It's like, well, great. I sometimes like the pseudo-intellectual stuff because it gives me different glimpses into it, and I like that kind of thing mixed in with my fiction. So I'm going to give this 4.5 stars, and hopefully, as you can see, you know, I like books that make me think and challenge me to think and challenge me to think about what other people are doing. And even just this blog post and stuff like that, I really enjoy books that make me think that and expose me to other ways of thinking. Well, not other ways of thinking, but, you know, just like get me going in some ways. And also battles between magicians and dragons. Awesome. So yeah, 4.5 stars. So if you enjoyed this review, if you've got anything to say, or if you've got any comments as well, please email me, luke@juggler.net. Otherwise, you can follow me on goodreads.com, become my friends on there, and you can follow my reading progress and comment directly on this review there on goodreads.com/LukeBurridge, I think is the best way to get hold of me. At Luke Burridge on Twitter, and also check out my blog, lukeburridge.com/blog. And you can read my fiction as well. I've got 3 novels up, short novels, two novels and a novella up on lukeburridge.com/fiction.html. I mentioned Combat, the second novel in the Minding Tomorrow sequence. But you can read it as the first book. I wrote 2 books set in the same world, but one is not the sequel of the other. You can theoretically read one, read this book 2 first or book 1 first. It's book 1, book A, and then book 3C will come, or 2B will come soon, later. It's 90% written, but it's been 90% written for about 9 months now. Anyway, that's it from me. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.